our longtime support of programming serving and featuring the area's queer community, and while we prepared to say goodbye to Out Loud, we welcome the opportunity for new programs to continue airing in Out Loud's time slot every Tuesday from 6 to 7 p.m. More information is available on the KBOO website at kboo.fm/outloud.
If you're interested in creating queer programming, come to KBOO on Wednesday, June 3rd at 7 p.m. for an information session. You'll learn about how to start a show, the trainings involved, and the obligations for being a KBOO volunteer, and more. Again, that's an information session for queer programming on Wednesday, June 3rd at 7 p.m. at KBOO, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon. More information can be found at kboo.fm/outloud.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Five Centers for the Arts, presenting The Bicycle Men, a bawdy musical comedy featuring Second City alumni. The Bicycle Men tells the story of Steve, a hapless American cyclist whose bike breaks down in a small French village. The Bicycle Men on stage June 5th through June 7th at the Winningstad Theater. Tickets and information at portland5.com.
I'm Dee Mae Roberts, stage and studio, on location at Artist Repertory Theater. With me is Artistic Director Damaso Rodriguez, who's about to open The Liar here at Artist Rep today. Yes, that's right, today. That show runs through June 21st on the Alder stage. Thanks for taking some time out from your opening day. You know, this is Friday right now, so people hear this on Tuesday, but this is your opening night.
Yeah, exciting times. Glad to be with you.
So The Liar, I want to talk about The Liar. It's a 17th century classical play by a French playwright, Pierre Corneille, and he's described as a contemporary of Molière and Racine, and he's supposed to be a tragedian, according to Wikipedia. But this new adaptation by David Ives seems to be a farce. So do you want to tell us more about that?
Yeah, it's a really outrageous comedy. And Ives, you know, is a very acclaimed, known contemporary playwright, and he has several very modern feeling plays, but he has created a career as what he calls a transladapter. So he takes a relatively obscure play and translates it and then adapts it into something fresh and modern that maybe feels like what the source material might have felt like to the audience in its time, but is irreverent because no one really knows the material. And you're right, Corneille was known as a tragedian, I guess, and he had a comedy or two. I don't know much about him, and the truth is Ives didn't know much about him either.
Never heard of him before, actually.
When he got offered, I'd vaguely heard of Corneille, but when Ives in his notes talks about getting a phone call from Shakespeare Theater in Washington, D.C. saying, would you like to do an adaptation of Corneille's The Liar? And he had never heard of the play, nor had his agent. And they said, don't worry about it. And so then he arrived at this wonderful, fun play, and he actually fell for it and fell in love with it. And that's why he adapted it. But it's fun to do an old play like this that feels fresh and modern and that no one knows. So everyone's discovering it together in the audience.
Well, so is this his only, you said there were a couple other comedies that he's done, but mostly this is probably his most well-known one, do you think?
But not well-known.
But nobody knows.
Exactly. Yeah. He wrote Les Cid, which is somewhat...
El Cid. Right?
Yeah, right. Known. And then there's another interesting Corneille adaptation by Tony Kushner of The Illusion, which is kind of almost like a Shakespearean romance. It's funny, but also a bit mythical, and I became aware of that play in the last 10 years or so.
Well, you know, as a playwright then, if people don't know the work and you're adapting it and translating it, you know, it seems like you'd have a lot more freedom to play with it.
Absolutely. I think all he wanted to do was capture the essence of the original and the kind of core story of this character who is sort of compelled to lie, and then he has a servant character, which is sort of his opposite, who literally cannot lie under any circumstances. And so that's a sort of duo at the center of the play. And then from there, there's all these mistaken identities. And there's a lot of this kind of like twin concept throughout the entire show. The women are named Lucrece and Clarice, right? There's a lot of opposites at play. And it's just really fun. He uses iambic pentameter in this, Ives does, and rhyming couplets. There's a few kind of modern anachronistic touches, but it's not like overly, you know, it's not referencing popular culture or anything like that, but it just feels really easy and fresh and fun, and that was his goal.
Well, you put a video about the language, too, and had the actors explain, it's a cast of what, about seven actors?
There's eight actors? Yeah.
And they were all explaining the language and having fun with that.
That's right, yeah, and we basically read Ives' note to the cast, which is that it's in iambic pentameter, he explained the rules of that, but he said the point of that is naturalness, the point of it is mainly fun, so just have fun. And that's been our approach to this. There are plenty of other classical texts where you want to kind of get into the social context and really dig deep and put forth a lot of dramaturgical research. That was not really what this show is about. This show is about playing with language and just kind of like helping a contemporary audience discover the kind of fun romp of this classical work without having to really struggle to connect to it.
And David Ives as a playwright is known for his comedic wordplay and just a writing really tight, witty comedy.
Yeah, he's one of the very top contemporary comic playwrights. There's really very few others. And in fact, it's just one of the reasons I'm so excited to produce this play and why it's being produced now throughout the country is that fresh, accessible, but smart comedies don't come along as often as we would like. That's one of the reasons Noises Off is produced so often. It's just because it's rare to encounter a play that is so funny beginning to end, but also smart.
Is it also PG-13 or
yeah, yeah, this is definitely a play that I think 10 and up, easy.
Yeah. And that's hard to find too, because a lot of farces could be a lot more, could cross boundaries a lot of times or offend people. Right. You know, there's that kind of humor too.
Right, and this certainly has all the innuendo you want, but you have to look for it. And I think if you're, you know, my 9-year-old son came to the final dress rehearsal, and that was just fine. You know, there's some potty language, which that age finds hilarious.
Yeah, that's nothing nowadays. So, and it has a multiracial cast, which I like too. So that gives a lot, especially with revamped classical work. It seems like that gives a lot of leeway in casting as well.
I think so too. I mean, the original material's in French, and we just talked about making something that's irreverent and fun. And so I never once thought about any kind of specific ethnicity or type in casting. I just wanted to get the most interesting, charismatic, funny company I could get, and really the cast is full of some of the most popular and talented and funny Portland actors that have been working in the scene for, you know, 10 years or more.
Well, and we're at the set. I should mention we're on location. You're listening to Stage and Studio on location at Artist Repertory Theater, talking with Artistic Director Damaso Rodriguez, who's about to open The Liar tonight, and the show runs through June 21st. And it's been in preview, and I understand those are going well, but we're looking at this gorgeous set. And I have to, if you were to describe it for our audience, how would you talk about it?
Well, I'd say it's sort of a stage within the theater space. So we've built a little platform stage area and a false proscenium arch. It's all blue and white and kind of inspired by the Tuileries Gardens, right? It's like a garden maze, but it's painted on the floor in blue over a kind of an off-white background. There's a stage, and then up center is this gorgeous map from 17th century Paris, and that is the dominant image in the set, and it forms a kind of a gorgeous backdrop and scrim that in production is lit in a lot of different ways and kind of puts it in context the whole time for us.
It's an intricate painting. I mean, it looks like it's an actual map from that time period.
It is an actual map that we had printed through, there are, you know, stage scenery companies that can make print large drops for you.
That's impressive. Yeah. And these huge doors. Anyway, it's a gorgeous set. So I encourage people to see The Liar, because I definitely want to see it. It sounds like a lot of fun. Now, we're in the Artist Repertory building, and you've already announced your next season. And I actually saw a piece on Oregon Artbeat on Cuba Libre. Yes. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, we're wrapping up this season, and we're really well into all of the planning and starting to execute a lot about next year. Cuba Libre is our sort of huge possibly kind of game changer project for us.
It's a huge cast. How the heck are you going to fund this?
Yeah. It's a production. It's a big musical. It's a new musical, and it's inspired by and using entirely the music of a Cuban timba group called Tiempo Libre, and then the play is called Cuba Libre, and it's not an autobiographical story, but it's certainly inspired. And the writer, Carlos Lacámara, whose play Exiles we produced in our current season, we've been developing the script for 3 years. We started by listening to the music of this band and learning about their story. They came from Cuba about a dozen years ago, and they were all classically trained musicians in the Cuban music training system there. And they really weren't allowed as young people to play contemporary American pop music. They weren't allowed to listen to it really. And so they have an album called My Secret Radio where it was based on the fact that they would go up on the rooftops of their various apartments, buildings, and rig their radio antennas to pick up American signal. And they would kind of teach themselves American music and kind of, you know, Cuban timbaize it, right? And so the musical kind of uses that idea, and it features a character who's a member of a band, and it's set in Miami in the present, where he's an adult, a grown man, about 40, and he gets a letter from his past, from a woman who it was basically his first love when he was in his early 20s before he left Cuba. And the play just transforms back to Havana, and we kind of learn about life in Cuba in the early 90s, which is the special period after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and this kind of infrastructure and funding kind of fell apart, and it was really a hard time just to get by in Cuba in particular. And so you learn about life in the 90s, and you learn about the music, and then he's perpetually in conflict with the sort of memory of this life that no longer exists, and sort of coming to terms with being a man and living in the present in America.
Well, it sounds really big, musical, lots of energy, lots of music, and great storytelling. And the rest of the season, one of the plays that I was really excited about, because I don't think I've seen versions of it on film, but I've never seen a production of The Skin of Our Teeth live. And imagining it here, because that is also a very big play.
Yeah.
It's got dinosaurs in it.
It does have dinosaurs in it. So The Skin of Our Teeth by Thornton Wilder, it's one of Wilder's masterpieces. It's a Pulitzer Prize winner, but is the lesser known one. Everyone probably knows Our Town. And Skin of Our Teeth is really, it's a three-act play about a family called the Antrobuses, right? And they're kind of the family of man. And the play is absurd. They, in the opening act, they have a scene in their living room, and their pets are a woolly mammoth and a dinosaur. They have two kids, one of them that sounds a lot like Cain of Cain and Abel, but they're dressed in kind of contemporary, clothing. And then there's talk of an ice age. And so each act, the world ends in a different way. And
I know, it's so revolutionary to think about. He wrote this in the 30s.
Yeah, yeah. You know? But if you think about it, you know, World War II was brewing, and the play was kind of about a survival and kind of a uniting experience for the people in the audience. And it's amazing to think an absurdist play like that opened on Broadway and ran very successfully. Sort of times have changed quite a bit, right? And so for us, I just think it's that the play is about community and really about how we all kind of cling to each other and hang on and survive, and that's what humans do. And I think that's just a great metaphor for theater too, and our theater community and our art. And I love that we're going to end next season that way.
Well, we only have like a couple minutes, so what other plays do you want to talk about for next season?
Oh boy, well, the season is a good mix of the brand new and the classical. We have The Miracle Worker around the holidays, which I think is just going to be a great opportunity to introduce artist rep to a wide audience that gets more young people in the theater.
I have to ask you this because I saw Tribes, and that had a hard of hearing actor, mm-hmm. or deaf actor.
That's right.
And so will you be thinking about a blind actress?
Well, it's important to us that we at least make every effort to make the process open and try to reach out and try to seriously consider an actor with a similar disability to Helen Keller, right, or Anne Sullivan. So the first step is to be open to it, you know?
That is so interesting. I just got chills thinking about that. So
yeah.
Anyway, that's the first step, right?
That's the first step.
And then what other plays are you
Well, doing? And then we have the full spectrum of sort of shows. I mean, we have a play by Jackie Sibley's Drury called We Are Proud to Present a Presentation, which is an enormously long title. It's about a company of actors that have gathered to try to retell the story of a genocide in Southwest Africa. And it's this really theatrical, meta-theatrical story that features a cast of three actors and three white actors. And it's just a phenomenal play that's been getting done around the country and in London. And it's extremely intense. And it's going to, you know, it will require a conversation afterwards about race and about how whose history becomes the published history. And that's the full spectrum from The Miracle Worker to this really challenging contemporary play. And I think that's what we're able to do here.
Wow. And is that the full season?
No, there's a lot of other shows in there. We're doing Terrence McNally's Mothers and Sons, which ran on Broadway just a couple of years ago and was Tony nominated. We are doing a new play that premiered off Broadway just last year called Grand Concourse by Heidi Schreck, which is set in a soup kitchen, industrial soup kitchen in a church in the Bronx. We are doing The Understudy by Teresa Rebeck, a backstage comedy that'll open the season. But it's cool because the play that the characters are working on is a long-lost Franz Kafka play. So it's just kind of an interesting milieu for backstage comedy.
Yeah, I haven't seen
a
Teresa Rebeck in a long time. She went to television for
a while there. Yeah, that's right. But she's kept putting out plays. And this is a fun, smart one. We have Vanna O'Brien, who's one of the founders of Artist Rep, doing a solo play called Broomstick by John Bignett, which was a play that was a part of the National New Play Network that's been touring around the country. We're doing our own production of it. And it's a witch in Appalachia that is talking to the audience about her past. And as you watch the play, you start to question, well, maybe she's not really a witch at all. And it's this smart, interesting solo piece that I would only produce because I know Vanna is perfect for it.
She's got such a following, too.
A following.
I don't know how you keep this all together in your head, but thank you so much for giving us a summary of the season. And, you know, it feels like Artist Rep is really moving ahead and combining some of the traditional work with the newer work and also bringing in, you know, other companies and creating this whole cultural center, which it feels like when you walk into this building with other nonprofit artist groups that are there. And I'll be talking with Profile pretty soon, but keep up the good work. It just feels very vibrant and alive here.
Thank you. Thanks for your support.
Don't forget to catch The Lyre running till June 21st at Artist Rep's Alder Stage. And for tickets and more info, visit artistrep.org or stageandstudio.org or call 503-241-1278. And so up next is Adriana Baer of Profile Theater Project. I'm DMA Roberts, stage and studio, on location at Artist Repertory Theater, where Profile Theater is housed as a company in residence of one of many at Artist Repertory Theater. With me is Adriana Baer, the artistic director of Profile Theater. And you're about to open a play that has a very funny title. I'm sure it's gotten a lot of recognition. Your playwright this year, because Profile does a playwright for the entire season, is Sarah Rule. And this play is going to open June 11th. And Sarah Rule has written this play called In the Next Room, or the Vibrator Play. I have read a little bit about it, and it sounds fantastic. It's a Victorian set comedy. Mm-hmm. And the interesting uses of electricity, shall we put it that way? And I'll let you take it away from there.
Yeah, so In the Next Room, or the Vibrator Play, is a beautifully written play. It was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize and a Tony Award. When it was written just within the last 10 years. It's one of Sarah Rule's most well-known plays, I think both because of the title and also because of the subject matter, and that is that it deals with the treatment of women's hysteria at the turn of the last century by use of electrical massage, i.e. vibrators. And it really is a play that grapples with women's roles in society as well as what we sort of assigned to women who were having things such as emotional feelings, and that had to be qualified as an illness, and how we treated that. And sometimes, in some cases, that was also true for men. So there is a male character in the play who's also being treated for hysteria. It is a very funny play, but it also has some very poignant and serious moments as well. So you have a woman, for example, who's recently given birth and her milk has not come in. She's trying to breastfeed and she's really suffering from feeling a lack of connection to her child, as well as being literally corseted into her clothing, and the effects that the society can have on women throughout that period. And it is interesting to think of it in terms of our own culture now.
Well, and, you know, if you look at it in the context of the time period, which is...
It's about 1885.
So, you know, things are happening. It's post-industrial revolution. There's a lot of inventions. And, of course, electricity and the car are starting to come about. But if you look at how the way women were treated in that time period for even speaking out or being difficult, they were sent to the madhouse. Some of them had hysterectomies, mm-hmm. you know. So, actually, a vibrator's not a bad solution.
Right, indeed. And it's interesting when you think of the word hysterectomy and hysteria, they would actually perform hysterectomies to rid women of their problems of crying and having opinions. So the vibrator, I mean, it's quite funny, really. We found a period textbook about the use of vibrators, and you can use a vibrator to treat all sorts of things. Hair loss, earaches, muscle fatigue, really anything you can think of, they would use a vibrator on. Now, I don't know if this was a book that was widely studied in medical practices, but they were certainly believed that the release of the body fluids was a way of releasing emotions.
Well, so I can't help but think about Meg Ryan in When Harry Met Sally, and that famous scene where she fakes an orgasm, right? I've read about other reviews of In the Next Room, and there was piano music at crucial times in the play when women were being treated. How are you handling that aspect of the play?
Well, one of my favorite stage directions of Sarah Rules is she says, remember that these women had no concept in the social and entertainment sphere as we do about what an orgasm was supposed to sound like. So think about what it might really truly be to experience this thing that you've never experienced and never even heard of and didn't know was possible. What is that actually like? So we're really working on thinking about what the body does when it releases, what the voice does when it releases, without Meg Ryan's influence. Because, you know, we've talked about that scene in When Harry Met Sally in the rehearsal room, and there's something about it where we say, oh, we have a cultural American understanding of what an orgasm is supposed to feel like. These women wouldn't have even known that faking an orgasm was a possibility. And what's also interesting about it is that it's not sexual. To them, it's medical. And to them, it's about treat me so I feel better. Of course, some women are lucky enough in the play to know that that can be achieved with one's partner or husband, but most women are not.
That is so interesting. Think about that time period when that wasn't, you know, there was no preconception. And you're right, for a lot of what we see in media or even in theater, there's a certain rhythm to things as far as what that's supposed to be. But this is really new for most of the women who are the characters in the play.
Yes, absolutely.
What drew you personally to this play? Because I know you love Sarah Rule.
That's a great question. I particularly love this play because of its genuine and honest exploration of what it is like to be a woman in a certain time, to be a parent, to be a mother, to be in a relationship. It really runs the gamut. There are many different types of romantic pictures in the show. It's not just heterosexual and it's not homogeneous. And so, well, I shouldn't say that they are all people. I suppose if I say they're not homogeneous, we might go to Edward Albee's The Goat or Who is Sylvia kind of play, which is not what this play is about. But
well, and you have men in this play, too. They're male characters. So they're, you know, it's definitely something that I think couples could be thinking about. All kinds of couples, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a very surprisingly diverse picture of love and the body and how we deal with things. The other thing that I was really drawn to was the purely political and social element of this play. Certainly the vibrator is a part of it. It's in the title. And we talk a lot about that because it's titillating and it's fun. But really, this play is about what happens with a group of people when they are repressed or oppressed, whether that's because of their class, their race, or their gender. And all three of those things are in this play. And I think it's an important exploration to examine how we view women, how we view people of different classes, people of different races, even right now, in terms of how we are interacting as a society. And I think the biggest visual metaphor I can offer is that of the costumes, in which these women are literally trapped in their own clothes because they're supposed to look a certain way. And the corsets caused a lot of physical trauma for women of this period. So that's a metaphor, certainly visually. And we're wearing a lot of corsets in rehearsal, and these poor actresses are feeling a lot of relief when they get to take them off.
Oh, I can attest to that. I was in Merry Wives of Windsor, and there was that whole, you know, very traditional corset on there. And there are times that you think you're going to faint. You know, mm-hmm. it's that constricting. Mm-hmm. So if you think about it in terms of that time period, women had to live this way and how confining that was. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And there is a line about a woman who's taking a walk. She walks a little extra quickly because she's excited about a conversation she's having. She ends up feeling very faint. And the doctor says, oh, do you feel faint often? She says, oh, no more than once a week, I dare say. And of course, the ironic thing is she's sitting there in a corset. We now know why she was feeling faint, but at the time, it couldn't possibly be something external. It had to be something wrong with her.
Well, so for this play, though, you're also offering some other aspects to this play with talkbacks, and you want to talk a little bit about that? And I think is there a panel discussion that's associated with this play?
Yeah, there are quite a few things we're doing with this production, all through our In Dialogue series, which is in place to expand the prism through which we view our featured writer's body of work. So we have, this is all on our website, but we have talkbacks post-show with the actors and the director, of course. But we also have a number of lectures and other opportunities to engage with the work, one of which is a panel that we're co-hosting with Oregon Humanities called Brave New World about gender equity in the arts. And that panel discussion will really look at exactly what it says, at where we are in terms of gender equity and the arts, not just performing arts. We're also doing a reading of Shakespeare's Measure for Measure in conversation with this play, looking at other representations of women in theater. We have a therapist who deals with sex therapy coming to talk. We have a professor coming to talk about the Victorian era. We have one night that's just pure fun where we're doing a meet and mingle with the cast, and then we'll be playing Hysteria Bingo if you'd like to learn more about hysteria. So we have a number of different opportunities to engage with this play in different ways. We also have 45th Parallel Chamber Music Ensemble. We have a year-long partnership with them. And this year they are creating a curated set of music based on the play that we're doing. So we'll have two nights of performances by them before the play.
Well, there's so much going on here at Profile Theater. In the Next Room, or the Vibrator Play by Sarah Rule. It opens at Profile on June 11th and runs through June 28th on the Morrison Stage at Artist Repertory Theater. For more information, visit profiletheater.org or call their box office at 503-242-0080. Adriana Baer, the Artistic Director of Profile Theater, thank you so much for, you know, just filling us in on In the Next Room. It sounds like it's going to be a fabulous play. What are you working on now, though? It's not going to be opening for a little bit. So what stage of rehearsal are you at?
Oh, we're in that wonderful place where we finally get to start running the show. So we have staged it. We've got costumes ready. We've got all the props, and we're rehearsing it over and over and over again. And we're going to be moving into the theater next week, where we'll get to do everything in our actual space.
So by the time people hear this on Tuesday, you're going to be in the theater.
That's right.
Adriana Baer, thank you so much for joining us today on Stage and Studio.
Thank you so much.
And Break Legs.
Thank you.
And that's it for Stage and Studio. I'm Dee Mae Roberts. If you missed any of the show, tune in to stageandstudio.org. You can also get us on iTunes and like us on facebook.com/stage, the letter N, studio. Till next time, I'm Dee Mae Roberts. Thank you.
And you're tuned to KBOO Community Radio 90.7. Up next, we'll hear Art Focus with host Joseph Galavan. Today's guest is Portland-based artist Arvy Smith, who's showing his work at Mark Woolley Gallery this month.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Improvisation Summit of Portland, June 4th through 6th at Disjecta in Portland. This all-ages event brings together musicians, dancers, and experimental performers for 3 days of improvisational art. Performers include Roscoe Mitchell, Jonah Parzan Johnson, Linda Austin, Gordon Ashworth, Either Neither, and many, many more. Again, that's the Improvisation Summit of Portland, Thursday, June 4th through June 6th at Disjecta, 8371 North Interstate Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Andy Warhol looks as green.